Dark Winter Nights is sponsored by ScratchBand. Think of all the things you touch in a day, and ask yourself how many of those things you'd want to rub your face against. Well, that's what you're doing when you use your hand to scratch your face, until now. ScratchBand is a medical-grade silicone wristband that allows you to use your wrist to scratch your face and avoid essentially rubbing your nose and mouth against every doorknob and grocery cart handle you touch in a day. ScratchBand, the dawn of a new evolution. More information at scratchband.life. Today on Dark Winter Nights, in honor of the recent Perseverance rover landing on Mars, we pull a real treasure from the Dark Winter Nights vault. This show comes from way back in our first season. One note, this show aired before Elon Musk was as much of a household name. Enjoy. In this episode of Dark Winter Nights, true stories from Alaska. One woman struggles with a major move.
I had one of my friends email me about it, and she was like, I don't know whether to be happy or sad.
And a man wonders what the point of it is.
You're nuts.
The Alaskan Martian, coming up next on Dark Winter Nights, true stories from Alaska. I'm Rob Prince.
This is one of the monumental interviews of history, as far as I'm concerned. I mean, can you imagine if you got like an interview with like a pilgrim? You know what I mean?
Yeah, that would be really cool. Yeah, I understand exactly what you mean.
Jessica Eicher was the only person from Alaska to make the first cut for the Mars One program. Mars One's mission is to send four astronauts to Mars, and they plan to pay for it by, among other things, selling the broadcast rights to their astronaut selection reality TV program. I guess it'll be like Survivor, Mars. What's the catch? Well, you know those astronauts? They can't come back. Think about that. For the first time in the history of humanity, a person is really struggling with the prospect of leaving Earth to live on another planet, permanently.
So what compelled you to apply for this program?
That would be my fiancé, David Barbeau. He's the one who told me about this, and he was like, we should totally do this. And at first I was like, you know, I don't know, this seems kind of weird, go to Mars, you know, but he totally talked me into it, and I was on board, and he totally supports everything that's happening right now, and we were really excited to apply, and so we decided to do it, and it was go big or go home kind of thing, like, let's just do it and see what happens.
So it wasn't even your idea?
Nope, not even my idea. So this is the email that I received from the Mars One committee being accepted into round two. And it says, Dear Miss Jessica Lynn Eicher, you and only 1,057 other aspiring astronauts around the globe have been pre-selected as potential candidates to launch the dawn of a new era, human life on Mars. Congratulations, you have made it to the next round. Now, catch your breath. We know you need details. We promise they are coming. In the meantime, here's what you need to do. And it continues on saying that we need to wait for a medical instruction for your health so they can make sure that you're healthy. And then it goes on to say you need to come into contact with other people, Facebook or interviewers such as yourself, and try to get your name out there and try to get the word out so that more people can support the program.
What went through your mind when you opened up this email?
Actually, it was a pretty upsetting moment. It was some random morning and I was laying in bed with Dave. We just woke up and we both had realized that we got an email from Mars One, and we decided to open them at the same time. And he didn't get chosen, and I just didn't say anything. because he knew that I would get chosen somehow. He's like, I always knew you would. And he wasn't chosen. And so we kind of just turned it off and went around our day for the rest of the day and didn't say anything. And then he came to me that evening and was like, I'm really happy for you. This is awesome. I'm going to support you. This is really great. I think you could go really far with this and it's going to change your life and you need to take advantage of it. And so I was trying to be, you know, just like, it'll come when it comes, you know. So I just put it off for a couple hours and he finally turned around and really supported me. And then that's when I was like, woo, got really excited.
Did you calculate the odds of yourself being selected yet? I'm talking about in terms of this, the cut you've already made.
Yeah, Dave went ahead and calculated that, the top 0.5%. Yep. That's actually, that was the first thing he said to me when he finally, like, came back and congratulated him. He's like, do you realize that you're the top 0.5% right now? And I was like, what? No way. Because I didn't calculate it, you know, I just kind of like let it go for a couple hours. And that was the first thing that he came to me with, was that statistic. It's pretty amazing.
And you're the only person living in Alaska who was selected for the program, correct?
Correct.
How does that feel?
It feels actually pretty awesome. I'm really excited to like represent Alaska in this, and I think it's really cool because it shows that people from all over the world are in this. I mean, there's people from Thailand, there's people from Korea, there's people from, like, I mean, it's everywhere. And it's really cool that there's only one person in Alaska and there's still 1,057 of us, which means that all those other people are somewhere else in the world, and it's just really cool to kind of like spread us out over the world.
What sort of interplanetary exploration experience do you have?
Interplanetary exploration. I'm going to go ahead and say none. I haven't been anywhere, not that I know of.
Have you been to Canada?
No, I haven't been to Canada. I know, unfortunate, right?
How has this changed your relationship with your friends specifically?
With my friends. They think I'm crazy. I had one of my friends email me about it, and she was like, I don't know whether to be happy or sad, just because, you know, is it, she believes that I could, you know, potentially go to Mars, and we're pretty close, and she's had a huge part in my life and in my education, and she's kind of upset that it may be a possibility that I'd be leaving, but at the same time, she's really happy for me because she knows that this is a huge step.
If your child came to you and said, I've been selected for the Mars One program, what would you think?
You're nuts.
What would you like your title to be for the purposes of this interview?
Oh, well, I always prefer my title to be Peter. But I understand that we should probably have some sort of professional
Peter of Peter Incorporated.
So I'm Peter Delamere. I have a PhD in physics from the University of Alaska Fairbanks. I'm an associate professor of space physics in the UAF physics department with a joint appointment at the Geophysical Institute. So take any part of that that you want.
Okay.
Preferably not Dr. Delamere. As a scientist, I'm always interested in asking scientific questions, and so my initial bias when I think about Mars One is, what are the scientific objectives? Before we talk about human exploration, tell me about the science and how human exploration is going to enhance scientific return. That's my first question for Mars One.
It's not good enough just to have people up there.
Right. It always seems to me that there's got to be something beyond just exploration, that we need to use humans to their fullest capacity to advance science. The question is can you do it safely? And is the science return you get from putting a human in place necessarily all that much better than having robotic missions. Because again, the human is very limited in what they can do still in a very tricky environment like Mars. In my view of the world, I would not want to send somebody somewhere without the possibility of returning them safely.
So that is your is that your main issue with the Mars One program? Is the
if you were to say ticket. If I had an issue, it is definitely the one-way ticket. I'm very concerned about the one-way ticket, and then I'm concerned with what is the potential for valuable scientific return by putting humans on Mars.
What is it about humans touching things, rocks and stuff, that is still better than robots?
Well, you know, really, we're trying to understand a lot about Mars, and we've done a number of robotic missions. We've tapped on rocks, we've prodded, we've poked. And ultimately, the only way to get meaningful results, or really comprehensive results, is to bring a sample return back to our Earth-based labs. Once we have the thing in our hands, there's a whole range of scientific tests that we can do. Chemical tests, physical tests, everything's on the table at that point, if we have it here on Earth. So one of NASA's objectives is to do a sample return mission. And that's a multi-phase task where, first of all, you have to identify what is it that you want to bring back. And clearly, you've got the whole surface to look at. And we've got very comprehensive imagery now from the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, very high-resolution imagery. We can see so much detail of the surface. We've got rovers roaming around in localized regions. So we probably are getting a better idea of where we'd want to take a sample return from. And so the plan was to initially establish the material we want, so a mission to basically cache the material, and then subsequent missions to actually go there and bring it back again. And the challenge is, to bring it back, you've got to land something on the surface, you've got to get the thing, and you've got to go back into orbit, not only into orbit, but back to Earth. So you've got to escape Mars's gravity, which is tough. Mars is a big planet. It's not like the Moon. The Moon was, you know, you could see just how the astronauts could bounce so high. It was low gravity. Mars is not a low gravity situation like the Moon. It's not Earth, but it's still a massive planet. And so there's a huge energy cost to getting something back into orbit, getting it to escape speeds back to Earth. And so the challenge of bringing a sample return back has basically stumped us. It's very expensive, and we're not there yet. NASA has a limited budget in the current budget climate, and trying to set priorities and amongst the many other scientific questions out there is tricky. It's tricky for us to balance with a limited budget.
So what were the benefits of having humans on the Moon? What did we gain by that?
We certainly demonstrated capability. Let's put it that way.
To the Russians?
To the Russians. For certain. Okay. We can do this. And it's pretty amazing that we did it under the gun, so to say. It was a race. Scientifically, we saw people driving rovers, making dust clouds.
So you're saying it was scientifically kind of pointless?
I hate to go that far, but from the science that I do, I don't see a whole lot of science value in that.
Wow. So do you see this as kind of a repeat of
That's what I'm afraid of. That's exactly what I'm afraid of. Let's not just do it for the sake of doing it. Let's actually do something that's scientifically meaningful in the process. So let's make certain those scientific objectives are very clearly defined and understand how putting humans in place can achieve those objectives.
What would be lost if we didn't put people on Mars? Is there anything that we would be set back by not doing this?
I'm always interested to hear different perspectives. So is it Elon Musk, the CEO of SpaceX and Tesla Motors? Mm-hmm. He's a proponent of, we must do this because we have no idea what the ultimate fate of this planet will be. Essentially, we need to be able to colonize other planets.
In the event that our own is no longer inhabitable.
In the event something goes wrong here.
Yeah.
And so in that sense, it's mandatory. You must do this. You must colonize other bodies in the solar system for the perpetuation, potentially, of the human species. I personally would rather just stay on Earth and accept my fate here rather than live on Mars.
When it comes to the actual, like, trip, what do you think about when you're thinking about it?
Dancing on Mars. That's the first thing I think about, actually. And I know that sounds really weird, but, like, come on. Like, you get there. And, like, what's the first thing you're going to do? You're not just going to be, like, all, like, calm and serious and, like... Like, I would just, like, start dancing, as awkward as that would be in that gravity. But, you know, I would be just so excited, and I would have to try, like... the Mars walk, not the moon walk. You know, I'd have to, like, I would just be so excited. And I don't think I would be able to, like, be this, like, serious adult. Like, I would be, like, so excited, and I want everyone else who'd be watching to be really excited. That's the first thing that I would do. And that's what I always think about. I think about dancing on Mars and just running around and picking up rocks and just enjoying life, like, totally different place. I think of it as, like, a fairy tale. That's what I think about. I don't think about the hardships that could come. I don't think about how bones are going to decay and we'll get sick and things like that and radiation. I don't think about that because it's not the most important part. The most important part is moving humanity forward, which is inspiring people to do crazy and wild things, like go dancing on Mars.
What is Mars like?
I'm trying to think of what it would be like. Imagine going to Antarctica temperature-wise. Or perhaps worse, having very little atmosphere to breathe, so you must wear a spacesuit. But this Antarctic environment isn't white and covered with ice. Instead, it's the Arizona desert, or worse, somewhere in the middle of the Sahara. There may be the occasional dust devil that rolls through. Interesting topology, very high mountains, that would be interesting, but not particularly conducive to the way that we're accustomed to living on Earth.
So it's sort of the worst of both worlds. You have the cold of Antarctica, but the desolate landscape of the desert.
Correct. That's my interpretation of Mars.
Now it's time for some Mars facts. You can decide if you'd be up to relocate. Mars is 140 million miles from Earth. I tell you, if I had a nickel for every mile Mars is from Earth. Anyway, the temperature can reach a quite pleasant 70 degrees Fahrenheit. At noon, at the equator, in the summer, or a low of, well, I'm sure they'll downplay this in the timeshare brochures, the lows can be about 225 degrees below zero at the poles. Here on Earth, the coldest recorded temperature was 128.6 degrees below zero in Antarctica in 1983. That's fairly balmy in comparison. Mars has 38% of our gravity, so someone like me who weighs 200 pounds, okay, I'm more like 215, but let's say 200 to keep the math simple. I'd weigh a trim 75 pounds on Mars. Now it's sounding better, huh?
Do you ever, like, sort of fantasize about what the trip is going to be like strapping into your seat and flying and landing? Do you do that?
I don't. Yeah, I think about, I'm like, hopefully I don't get, like, space sick. You know? I don't want to get, like, car sick, quotes. And I could just, like, picture myself being, like, totally smashed into my seat for a while, and then, like, nothing, you know, while you're traveling, just, like, zero G floating around. That would be fun. And I think the landing would be the most nervous moment of my life, I think, would be going into land. When you're flying a plane, that's when I get most nervous. Like, that's the part that's, like, you know, it's easy to fly in the air, it's easy to get off the ground, but getting back onto the ground safely is a big task. And so the landing would be the most nerve-wracking part, I think.
For human exploration, first of all, I struggle to imagine for myself sitting in a small capsule for a year.
Just to get there.
Just to get there.
Just to interrupt real quick, according to Mars One, it would be more like 6 to 8 months, but they're probably not taking into account the traffic.
Second of all, is the space environment between here and Mars is not necessarily safe. The sun is sporadically very active. We have these coronal mass ejections which come out. This is partly what gives us some of our very spectacular auroral displays on Earth, is these events that come from the sun. And the problem is this can be a potentially high radiation environment. And so if one of these events, these CMEs, were to encounter the spacecraft, you need some mechanism to shield the astronauts from radiation and potentially high energetic particles in particular. And so that's something to consider. It's not that you can just go on cruise for a year, but you have to really think safety first. So just getting a human being to Mars is not risk-free. There is a significant risk there to start with.
Has this impacted your thoughts about children or anything like that?
Yes, because it would be really unfortunate to have kids and then leave them. But, I mean, wouldn't it be cool to be that kid, though? That you're like, oh, by the way, like, where's your mom at? Oh, she's on Mars. Like, you know, come on. Like, it would be unfortunate to leave your children behind, but at the same time, like, giving them that opportunity to be in that type of lifestyle and given those opportunities, like, that's really beneficial too, I think.
At first, I thought Jessica was crazy to even consider leaving children behind to go to Mars. She's not a parent yet. I am. And I know how having a child can change your outlook on life. But think about it. The first people to colonize Mars will make Buzz Aldrin and Neil Armstrong look like amateurs. You think George Washington or Christopher Columbus were big? These astronauts will be at a level above and beyond anything we've ever seen before. Their children and their children's children will be revered for centuries. So, certainly it would be unthinkably hard for Jessica to leave her children behind. But they would also become a permanent part of human history. I mean, think of how many parents abandon their kids for no good reason.
How long does it take to send a signal? For example, if, you know, one of the Mars One colonists wants to make a video call back to Earth.
There will be a significant delay. So it comes at the speed of light. I can't do the calculation off the top of my head.
According to Mars One, communication between Earth and Mars can take anywhere from 3 to 22 minutes.
Your Skype session would be significantly delayed.
Is there another space priority that you wish people would pay more attention to?
So I'm always I get personally, for the science I do, I get a lot of science return out of robotic missions. And we can do robotic missions at a fraction of the cost of human exploration. And so again, when we look at science return, we get a lot of bang for the buck out of robotic missions. And so, and all you have to do is carve out a fraction of the human exploration budget and you can do a lot of science robotically. And so, that may be part of my skepticism, but again, I'm a huge fan of good science.
Is there a benefit just in seeing what happens to humans when they live on a planet other than Earth?
There absolutely is. I would like to, if we want to explore human exploration, we clearly need to do something with the space station. Space station is an asset that we have right now, and unfortunately we don't have a vehicle to get there. We're relying on Russia to get us there right now because of our space shuttle program basically coming to an end. So we need a new vehicle. It's never clear what, a lot of money goes into space station. I'm not certain, in my opinion, that it's fully utilized in its current capacity. I'd like to see more done locally before our ambitions to go to places like Mars really come to fruition. We have no idea. It may be optimistic thinking that we can actually land on Mars and set up a colony, get water, start to produce food, hope that the solar panels work. If everything goes error-free, maybe everything's fine. But there's always this unknown element. What if something catastrophic goes wrong and you have no way of returning? To me, it's unacceptable to take mortality as a consequence, a side effect of doing this endeavor. Then what have you accomplished? Certainly, if mortality is reality, then there's no science return. And again, I feel like there needs to be some sort of higher motivation for doing this. We need to have science return as a byproduct of this.
If Mars One doesn't have a major scientific payoff, does that mean it isn't worth doing? Are there other valid reasons to go to Mars than just for the science? I leave those answers up to you. In the meantime, you can savor being part of the first human generation who's had to really grapple with the idea of leaving Earth for good.
Let's imagine that you figure out that you're going. What goes through your mind the minute you hear that you're going?
Can you imagine that moment, though? Can you really imagine that moment? No one's ever left for, like, ever. But I think there'd be a part of me that would... It'd be like a gut drop, like, oh my gosh, this is real. And then it would be like, all right, I'm ready to dance on Mars. That would be, you know. And then there'd be this really sad lull, because then it's like, okay, now I'm leaving everyone. But at the same time, it's like, I'm leaving everyone for a really good cause, and I'm only leaving them in, you know, person. It's like, they're not like gonna forget about me. Like, it's not like I'm forever gone, vaporized. You know, like, there'll be communications on Mars. There'll be ways to talk to people, and then I'll have the other three astronauts as well. So even though you're leaving people, I feel like those three other astronauts, you'll be the best friends of all time, because there's only four of you, so you have to get along, right?
And anybody who really would like to do Mars One, I would encourage them to go spend 3 or 4 months at space station and then come back and tell us again, this is what you really want to do.
We had talked about colonizing the moon maybe first, mm-hmm. trying that out for a while.
Try the moon, and if you like the moon, go for Mars.
It's going to really suck, but it's huge, and it will change the world, and it's, if that's what my life is, that if that's the meaning of my life, then I'm going to do it, and I'm going to take the opportunity to, like, change everything.
Thanks so much to Jessica Eicher and Peter Delamere for their help with today's episode. In the time since we interviewed Jessica, Mars One selected 100 people from the 1,000-plus who made the first cut. Unfortunately, or fortunately, depending on how you look at it, Jessica did not make that second cut. We wish you the best of luck, Jessica, and we're glad you're going to be sticking around here on Earth with the rest of us. Today's episode was produced and edited by myself, Rob Prince. Thanks to Megan Murphy for connecting me with Jessica. Audio and story consultation by Lori Neufeld. Remember, these are the stories we tell up here in Alaska on dark winter nights. I'm Rob Prince. Dark Winter Nights is sponsored by ScratchBand. Think of all the things you touch in a day, and ask yourself how many of those things you'd want to rub your face against. Well, that's what you're doing when you use your hand to scratch your face, until now. ScratchBand is a medical-grade silicone wristband that allows you to use your wrist to scratch your face and avoid essentially rubbing your nose and mouth against every doorknob and grocery cart handle you touch in a day. ScratchBand, the dawn of a new evolution. More information at scratchband.life.